This is the Popmatic podcast for February 3rd, 2016. It's African American History Month.
It seems to me that the artist's struggle for his integrity is a kind of metaphor for the struggle which is universal and daily of all human beings on the face of this terrifying globe to get to become human beings.
This is the Popmatic podcast where you can rock out with your library card out. I am Brian, and joining me today are
Amanda,
Mike,
Bill.
Jeremy.
This is your first episode of the year.
Welcome back.
I knew Jeremy once.
Thanks.
Special guest.
Thanks, guys. I'm out of retirement. Just when I thought I was out, you pulled me back in.
You escaped your ice cave.
Yeah. I escaped a lot of caves. It's like, I don't know.
Good save, man. Good save.
Yeah.
It was that guy that cut his arm off.
February.
125 hours guy?
Yeah. 27.
Whatever. Only the thoughts of Elvis Costello.
February.
It's like an old glove.
February is African American History Month. The theme this year is Hallowed Grounds, sites of African American memory. And holy crap, do we have a lot of those sites in Nashville. If you don't believe me, come to the Civil Rights Room at the main library. And that's just a few short years in the 20th century. The things that you can learn about in the Civil Rights Room, though we have booked small periods. Holy crap, there are going to be a lot of events here at the library in February. I'll put in a link in the show notes to all the events. You can browse. Also, if you go to a local branch, you pick up the latest issue of Unbound, just look for the little African continent icon. Those are African American History Month themed programs. More on that later. First, we're going to tell you about our favorite books, movies, and music by or about African Americans.
I'm ready, dude. Just
all right,
be
go.
A peach and go.
On February 4th, 2016, at high noon or 12 o'clock, my boss Crystal Dean's Killer Thriller Book Club will discuss A Rage in Harlem by Chester Himes, which introduces Coffin Ed Johnson and Gravedigger Jones, two Harlem detectives. This is a series of novels featuring the two detectives, and this is the first book in the Harlem cycle. In brief, a man named Jackson, who works for a local undertaker, borrows money from his boss and loses it in a con game. He is set up by his girlfriend, Emma Bale, and then the plot thickens. In doing research on Chester Himes, who wrote the book, he got the writing bug while he was doing time in prison for armed robbery. He sold short stories to magazines, and by doing this, he won the respect of the guards and the other cons, and he kept himself out of trouble. He even wrote a book about his experience called Yesterday Will Make You Cry, which we have in our collection, and the book also includes a neat introduction by Melvin Van Peebles. Also, in the Coffin Ed and Gravedigger Jones series, we have The Heat Is On, The Heat's On, Blind Man with a Pistol, and Bang. This with other Chester Himes standalone novels. So now is a good time to read Chester Himes, and don't forget about the Killer Thriller Book Club on February 4th, 2016, and you can discuss A Rage in Harlem and Chester Himes himself. Mike?
Yeah, I'm about 50 pages in, and it's really good so far, even though, like, the Gravedigger Jones and Coffin Ed, like, don't really show up until, like, way late. I was like, this is like a cop novel. Where it felt very crime-heavy at the beginning, but... Yeah. That, and I heard that the audiobook, at least on Audible, is narrated by
Samuel L. Jackson. We've got it on CD.
Ooh, yeah. That's cool enough on it, though.
Yeah.
So, in addition to obvious stuff like academics and alcohol poisoning, one of the benefits of college is that you can discover who you are, away from parental and or the societal influence. You know, you can recreate your identity to become whoever you want to be, or reaffirm who you always were. I know in my case, I continued being a stunted adolescent until my early 30s.
I'm ready to plan.
You know, hey, guys, can we go to the sock hop? You're 29.
This is in 1956.
I was going to say, an adolescent in the 1950s.
I was an adolescent George Lucas.
Spoiler alert, I'm immortal. Today I thought that...
makes so much sense.
Kids
teach us
days.
About black history. You've seen a lot of it.
You guys would not believe the sights I've seen. Today I thought I would talk about a movie with sort of same theme, I guess, called Dear White People from the distant year of 2014, directed by Justin Simeon.
I'm going to hop in here because now it seems like you say sort of the same theme. It means like being immortal, and it's not about being immortal. It's about discovering yourself when you go to college.
The kids in the background a young Highlander who hasn't been stabbed
yet. It should be related to that same theme because that was a touching intro. If it's not related, then what are you, me?
I'm getting there. It's kind of an ensemble piece focusing on a handful of black students at an elite, mostly white, fictional Ivy League college called Winchester University.
This fall, in the tradition of The Help, The Blind Side, and The Butler, comes a new film.
How come the only black movies Hollywood wants to make are ones with black mammies in fat suits?
Yeah. Or black women in pain, man.
So basically, we got black people dying in the past and black people dying in the present.
A movie with, you know, characters in them instead of stereotypes wrapped in Christian dogma.
Why is every educated person inherently evil?
Most people are here to see Fang 9. It's got two chains in it.
Oh, damn! I read your entire 15-page unsolicited treatise on why the Gremlins is actually about suburban white fear of black culture.
The Gremlins are loud, talk in slang, are addicted to fried chicken, and freak out when you get their hair wet.
The main characters are Sam, who's a DJ who has a show called Dear White People, where in between songs she says stuff like, "Dear white people, this just in, dating a black person to piss off your parents is a form of racism." There is her ex-boyfriend, Troy, who is the son of an administrator at school, who is pressured by his father into becoming an athlete and an overachiever and all that stuff, but he really just wants to be a comedy writer. There's Coco, who is a YouTuber who cares about nothing but social status and page views. Or does she? And lastly, there's black gay nerd Lionel, who's asked to write a piece for the school newspaper on what it's like to be a black student at Winchester. So he tries to like infiltrate all these like social groups that he's usually too shy to like really get into. The plot really starts kicking in early on when Sam becomes the head of the all-black dorm on campus, beating in an election, which is interesting because I didn't know you could elect that sort of thing, beating Troy, who everyone expected to win. There's this big scene where Troy gets chewed out by his dad, who's played by President Palmer from 24, Dennis Haysbert.
I love him.
The one season I watched, I was like, President Palmer's the best.
He really was. I would vote for him.
Yeah. 4 more years. You could tell that Troy tries really hard, but it's never enough for his father, who worked incredibly hard to get to his place in the administration, but still has to fight his racist peers all the time. Troy eventually gets a chance to get into an all-white fraternity. More of that later. Coco gets offered a spot in a reality show, but the producers rather have Sam because she has better on-camera presence and lighter skin. Lionel eventually discovers that his white friend at the newspaper is just using him to get a story, and there's no chance of him actually getting a job there, or that, you know, he even, like, starts to, like, come onto him, but, you know, eventually he realizes that he's just wanted a story and he doesn't really care. Eventually, all the plot lines converge when the lily-white head of the fraternity that Troy wants to pledge in decides to have a frat party in all-black face, you know, because it's a joke, because of comedy.
He's doing finger quotes just for those finger listening
quotes,
at home.
Gang. I like finger quotes. The end credits show national headlines where real-life Greek organizations help parties in blackface from it seems like there's like a couple every year for the past like 20 years. It's kind of depressing. Like a lot of satires, it's both funny at times and dark and depressing at others. I'm not 100% sure it completely gels as a movie, though. Some of the scenes are way too long, and some of the Family Guy-style flashbacks don't really work. But overall, I think I recommend it. I'm definitely interested in what Simeon does next. And I thought that the woman who played Sam, Tessa Thompson, was outstanding. I've really been really disappointed that she's only been able to get, like, the girlfriend in Creed or the background character in Selma, since she deserves way better.
But she played, didn't she play Diane Nash in Selma?
Yeah, I heard that she's an actual, like, a person, but, I mean, she didn't really say much. It was kind of disappointing.
A very important person in the history of Nashville.
Yeah.
Nashville.
Yeah, named after her.
Take a trip to the...
Take a
trip to the civil rights room, Mike. Quite a few pictures of Ms. Nash in there. But anyway.
We got Amanda.
Okay, I'm going to talk about a movie. A couple years ago, NBC decided to take a page from Bill Murray's movie Scrooged and start staging huge live musicals at Christmas.
I got excited for a second. I thought they were going to have Scrooged in musicals.
That would be awesome. I would watch that.
100% watch that.
They did The Sound of Music first, and I was kind of disappointed, but I did enjoy mocking the fact that Rolf was 17 going on 35. Last year, they did Peter Pan, which I didn't even watch because I don't like Peter Pan that well, because I'm perpetually confused by why he's played by a girl.
There was no hook for you?
Wow.
Didn't get me.
It's me.
But this year, NBC got its groove back and chose The Wiz for its big live Christmas extravaganza.
Just click your heels 3 times and think of home.
When I think of home, I think of a place where there's love overflowing.
For the NBC Wiz Live, you are Dorothy.
Since I got the part, everything's been changing.
It feels amazing because I really connect with it.
I'm the all-seeing, all-knowing, all-powerful Wizard of Oz. I know stuff.
Our brand new Dorothy, who will be introduced to the world. I'm really excited to just get to see her and get to meet her and see who this unknown, soon-to-be superstar is going to be.
Oh, the Wiz lives in Emerald City, right at the end of the Yellow Brick Road.
The Yellow Brick Road?
I've known the music from The Wiz for a while, but I've never actually seen it all the way through from the beginning to the end. And unfortunately, on show night, I did not make it home in time to watch. Sad face. But luckily, the library saved my bacon because they got the DVD less than a month after it aired.
Yeah.
I have also never seen another version, so I don't really have anything else to compare it to. But I have to admit that I really liked this one. The staging and the costumes were really beautiful and colorful and artistic. But what I think worked the best was actually the casting. Stephanie Mills, who originated the role of Dorothy on Broadway in the original 1975 production of The Wiz, returns to play Aunt Em. The rest of the cast is made up of a bunch of big-name actors like Queen Latifah, Mary J. Blige, David Alan Grier, who... seriously, who knew he could sing? He does a pretty good job. Neo, Common, and then Amber Riley, formerly of Glee. The library's DVD also has a documentary about the making of The Wiz, and you can see how they found newcomer Shanice Williams, who played Dorothy. She was actually on break from school, saw the audition online, and just wanted to try it for the experience. She figured she wouldn't get it, but she ended up being cast in this major production. She wasn't my favorite character, but for her first big role in anything, she did a great job, and she really does have a wonderful singing voice. So if you want to hear Shanice and the new cast, the library also has the soundtrack from the movie on CD. Now, if you're sitting there scoffing because how dare NBC modernize a classic show like The Wiz, have no fear. We also have the CD soundtrack and DVD of the original 1978 movie, which stars Diana Ross and Michael Jackson. I have not seen that one yet, but I am on hold for it. I actually tried to watch it. It was on BET on one of the vacation days we've had off here lately. But it had like 5 minutes of show and 10 minutes of commercial. It was going to take like 5 hours to watch. I'm like, yeah. I'll just wait for the library to save me. So I am glad NBC picked The Wiz, and I'm doubly glad that they kept it more like the stage play than trying to make it into like a movie. So check this baby out and ease on down the road.
They're doing a bunch of those. It's like Fox is doing Grease.
Yeah, I saw that.
And then Rocky Horror Picture Show is coming.
Really?
Yeah.
Rocky Horror Picture Show, I think, is a series. Like, it's not just
really?
A special.
Oh, yeah. What's, I can't remember her name. She's on Orange is the New Black.
The actor playing Frankenfurter in the new Rocky Horror Picture Show series is Laverne Cox. She also plays Sophia on Orange is the New Black. Uzo Aduba plays Suzanne, a.k.a. Crazy Eyes, on Orange is the New Black. And was also in the recent live broadcast of The Wiz.
Okay, so we'll go with some context here, as I like to do. On April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King was assassinated. And 3 days later, President Johnson signed into law the Civil Rights Act of 1968, which provided equal housing opportunities for Americans regardless of race, creed, or national origin. And then, in October of that same year, Night of the Living Dead was released. In this film, the dead have returned to life to feast on the flesh of the living, and Dwayne Jones stars as Ben, one of the survivors of this strange phenomenon. He's barricaded in a house with a small group of survivors, and slowly but surely their safety erodes. By the end of the night, Ben is the lone survivor until, spoiler alert for a 48-year-old movie, he's mistaken for one of the zombies and is gunned down by a roving band of law enforcement and do-gooders. It looks a little like a lynch mob. Now,
spoiler alert.
Wow. And here's the ending game.
I didn't know that. So now you really spoiler alerted the spoiler alert. So
this movie is in the public domain, so...
If you haven't seen
it, if it's 48 right. years old.
I think like 30 years or older is fair. It's fair game. I don't want to spoil anything for anybody. But like 30 years or older, it's like if it's older than you are... Then you get an additional 10 years. That's the way I see it. I'm 36, so that's the fuzzy math I'm using. So why am I talking about this during our discussion of African American History Month? Well, Dwayne Jones was the first African American actor cast as the lead in a horror film. And the next film in the series, Dawn of the Dead, is much more explicit in its commentary on consumer culture and stuff, but Night of the Living Dead can kind of be read in a bunch of different ways. Director George R.R.R.R.R. Romero has been cagey about his intentions with the film, and that's given critics a lot of room to see it as an allegory for Vietnam War and the collapse of the 60s counterculture, or just as a gory B-movie. Now, despite the historical significance of Dwayne Jones' casting, George Romero claims to have only cast him simply because he gave the best audition. And that may certainly be true, but he sort of had to realize the implications of casting a black man as the lead role in a film in 1968, especially given the character's role in the film. Ben is the leader of this group of survivors, and all the other survivors are white. And sort of he quickly sort of takes charge of the situation. He exposes this man, Harry, played by Carl Hardman, as a coward, and he even slaps a white woman, Barbara, played by Judith O'Day, in the face in that sort of classic scene of, like, calm down, I'm going to hit you, calm down, I'm going to hit you, which you don't really see in movies anymore. What a shame.
But also at the time, that was...
Yeah, that's a big
insanity.
Yeah, that's a big.
A black man slapping a white woman could literally get killed.
Yeah, it's in certain places in this country.
It's a big deal. But despite all of that stuff, his race is not a plot device in the film. It's not an opportunity for a monologue about working together to make a difference. So, in the context of the story, it sort of plays no role whatsoever, which is kind of revolutionary. But his casting certainly helped transform the movie into something beyond its sort of B-movie kind of status, and sort of gave it another layer to dig through. So after his death, at the end of the film, which I'm spoiling for you now, there's a...
I won't listen.
there's a montage of newspaper...
You're going to spoil Day of the Dead, too.
there's a montage of newspaper clippings and photographs showing the dead zombies being disposed of and law enforcement going around through fields with the dogs. And they look a lot like real-life headlines of 1968, full of violence and turmoil and riots and, you know, lynch mobs and all of this sort of stuff. And so Dwayne Jones, the person, he is kind of a fascinating guy. He graduated from the Sorbonne and worked in education in addition to being an actor. And according to the New York Times, he headed the literature department at Antioch College from 1972 to 1976. He helped start an English language instruction program with the Peace Corps, and he helped found the Harlem Preparatory School in addition to heading its English department. He had a few other film and TV roles throughout his career, but he mostly worked on stage. He was executive director of the Black Theater Alliance and directed over 20 productions, and he died in 1988 at the age of 51. So Night of the Living Dead We have it on DVD, but it's also available on Hoopla. You can also find it for $2 at a bargain bin because George
it's
Romero.
It's public domain. Yeah. You could get it virtually for free almost anywhere.
Yeah.
Also, I would like to – there's this great documentary. Mm-hmm. I think the library has it, and it's on Netflix. I've been showing it, but it's – a. I think it's called The Birth of the Living Dead.
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet.
Interesting documentary about the making of that movie. They interview George Romero, several of the cast members, and just the influence that that movie has had.
Yeah. They're coming to get you, Barbara, indeed.
Yes.
You know, the idea about, like, you know, its multiple meanings, I just think that for people that have never seen The Night of the Living Dead because they think that they don't like horror movies... You know, there's a reason why George Romero has the reputation that he does. It's just an amazing movie, regardless of genre, and it has so many different interpretations because it's an amazing work of art. Mm-hmm. Because of the racial history of America, especially the ending of that movie, just has all these really heavy, intense connotations, and it's an amazing film if you've never seen it.
Yeah, I have to wonder, like, if that was the original intention of it, and he's just sort of being... cagey about it or whatever, but like if not, like that, it definitely gave it even more impact.
I bloviate just to say, if you never checked it out, check it out.
It's worth your time.
I need a watch buddy.
Little girl eating her mom is
zombies
like, so
might get me.
They move slow though. They're
okay,
slow.
I cannot run them. I'm not
no
fast.
No fast zombies. That's a 21st century. Invention.
And George Romero got to start working with Mr. Rogers. Oh. I just love that aspect.
I'm repressing all of my Pittsburgh.
PA Proud!
Yeah, really. Yeah, you know.
Many PA anecdotes. I'm repressing them all.
Oh, just start saying a bunch of polysyllabic words.
You're redneck southerner, location. But that whole movie has rednecks. Pennsylvanians.
Well, these guys are mad. They're all pissed off.
Gotta shoot.
I'll get it. Family legend. My mom and dad saw that movie in the theater. My dad was scared. My mother never let him live it down, even to this day. Okay.
You like your dad.
Okay. So.
That's awesome.
They probably saw it in 68 in PA at a drive-in theater.
That's
awesome.
That's very cool.
So, okay. Of course, I'm going to make things serious because I'm real serious.
Ooh, no.
So I mentioned a lot of events are happening at the library for African American History Month. The one that gets me most excited is the Our Story Matters Wikipedia Edit-a-thon. That is going to be
Saturday, February 13th.
From 11 to 4, that's all afternoon. Just come hang out. We'll edit some Wikipedia articles. We'll especially edit Wikipedia articles about Black history, in particular about places of note here in Nashville. If you've never edited Wikipedia and you don't know how to do it, just show up. We'll show you how to do it. If you don't know what to edit or the topics to edit, don't worry. There will be suggestions about what you could edit. And if you're worried about sources, we'll get to that too. We got that fixed. But check this out. Last year I did this. I went to this Wikipedia edit-a-thon. It was really amazing. I learned about Callie House, who before that Wikipedia edit-a-thon did not have a Wikipedia entry. And in the turn of the 19th century, she was actually the president of the National Ex-Slave Mutual Relief Bounty and Pension Association. So this is one of the first places that took a political position for reparations for slavery, which after the Civil War actually was like not a controversial idea at all. Like a lot of people were pushing for it. But also, if you notice, the name of this organization was the Ex-Slave Mutual Relief Bounty and Pension Association. So what it would do was, like, basically provide pensions to Civil War veterans, or if people were in financial trouble, like, if you were a member of this association, they would, like, help you out if you were in a jam financially. But what's funny was the racist government at the time did not want this association to exist, and they weren't actually doing anything illegal. So what they did, though, was they actually charged her with postal fraud, saying that letting people believe that you would get reparations for slavery was a stupid idea, so you were actually frauding them, even though everyone that was in, even though they actually didn't fraud anyone or steal anyone's money, it was just a way to frame her. And she still kept going and kept this organization going, even though she was constantly being harassed by the postmaster. she was a woman. This was in the like the very end of the 19th century and the early 20th century. She was from Nashville. She did this from Nashville. Now, in 2015, the Research Center for the Study of Black Cultures and Politics is actually named after Callie House at Vanderbilt University, which is really cool. Now, if you wanted to go a little deeper, the library has a book, My Face is Black is True, Callie House and the Struggle for Ex-Slave Reparations by Mary Frances Berry. The library owns this book, and a lot of the primary sources in this book actually came from our Special Collections Center. So the author came here to do research, and it's about, you know, this person that not a lot of people know a lot about who was from here in Nashville. Now, I said that I would go back to the idea of sources. One of the reasons why it's really a smart, fun idea for libraries to have Wikipedia edit-a-thons is we have amazing primary sources, in particular about African-American history in Nashville in our special collections. So if you come, you're going to have a lot of awesome sources, oral histories, rare books, things like that that are not available just at home if you're doing research. So that is at Saturday, 11 to 4 p.m., Our Story Matters, Wikipedia edit-a-thon. Check it out.
What date did you say? What you're saying
is our library helped create that Wikipedia entry. Is that where you were going with it?
Our library helped create the book, which helped create the Wikipedia entry, which people use every day all over the world.
Right. Yeah.
And you can be part of that knowledge cycle.
Yeah.
If you come to the library Saturday,
February 13th.
Hey guys.
Hey Brian.
Hey,
what do we do on Tickle My Fancy?
Well,
maybe the library has it.
Maybe the library does it.
But either way, it's tickling our fancy.
Well, in the past month, I've read two books that could go with today's theme, Shock Upon Shocks. But they're written by white guys, so I did not recommend them in the main segment. I'll start with the book you would expect me to like, and then I'll go to the surprising one. Lovecraft Country by Matt Ruff is about a black family in 1950s Chicago and their interactions with Lovecraftian spookiness. So you see, way back in the 1790s, one of those old-timey Lovecraftian natural philosopher, wizard, redneck, dimension ripper, whatever.
How many adjectives are in that sentence?
It's the longest sentence. He has this, like, you know, he had these go-to themes he enjoyed, and, you know. One of those old-timey wizard guys died, and his only descendants are the children he had with a former slave. So cut to the present day, as in present day 1950s. A distant white cousin starts to manipulate the family into doing his dark bidding. And in a series of really good pastiches of Lovecraft stories, like The Dreams of Witch House or The Festival, I really liked Rust's descriptions of life in the Jim Crow era. The everyday indignities that the family had to suffer for no reason at all really stuck with me. It's really just, you know, they interacting with white people in any way is just depressing. I like that it's Lovecrafty. Yeah. I like that it's Lovecrafty and also kind of confronts Lovecraft's racist tendencies head on. It officially comes out in a couple weeks. I read an advanced reading copy because I'm amazing. And the last book I was going to recommend today is called Deep South by Paul Theroux. It's a travelogue of the Deep South. Theroux has been all over the world, but he had never been to the southern United States. Instead of hitting obvious tourist traps, he sets out for small towns, farms, just talking to people on the side of the road, mostly in Alabama, Mississippi, and Arkansas. It's really depressing hearing about how institutional racism is still a thing. All over the South.
That's why it's an institution.
Oh, it's so depressing. The only bits that had any, like, to do with my life is, you know, it was not in this book. he's struck by how much a dying town in the South feels like a village in Africa or India, yet those villages get aid from charitable organizations or the U.S. government, while dying Southern towns are left on their own. The only real downside to me is that he says that Southerners don't read, and if they do, they don't read his stuff. Hey, Buttface, I just held my 10th bookcase in 9 months. But whatever.
How do you really feel?
Grr. What do you got, Brian?
Buttface.
I was curious about that because I heard that, like, a lot of Southern people kind of felt like he didn't give us a fair shake or whatever.
You know, he doesn't talk to white Southerners almost at all.
But to be fair, the South has no sort of rich literary tradition. I mean,
he does go into this, like, side bit about, like, yeah, he talks a lot about, like, William Faulkner.
Yeah.
You know, lots of William Faulkner.
But like one of the two titans of American literature isn't from the South or anything. Buttface.
Yeah.
Sorry, problematic.
Yeah, I was kind of annoyed.
Or the South is still crazy racist and he's not from here, so he's brave enough to say it. Okay.
Whatever, his name has an X in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He got all annoyed because people call him
Michigan isn't.
Oh, I like this. I like this. Good point. Okay. I got to tell you, like, you know that Victor Lavalle is coming out with The Ballad of Black Tom, which is, like, a Lovecraft story that in some way, like, flips the race Lovecraft script.
Ooh, that could be good.
Yeah. Do you ever read Victor Lavalle?
No.
I really want to.
Yeah. So he's like this black crime author who likes Lovecraft, but, you know, there's all this, how do you avoid Lovecraft's racism? So he's coming out with this book called The Ballad of Black Tom. I think it came out digitally on Tor.com already.
Oh.
But the paperback comes out February 16th, and I'm kind of excited about what he's going to do with that.
Groovy.
Which brings me to what I was going to talk about today. I was going to talk about music. You know, there's this one record that keeps popping up at everyone's, like, year-end lists, including Crystal, who I trust a lot, and that is Ratchet by Shamir. And I especially like that it's called Ratchet, because Ratchet is one of those words that's, like, it's becoming controversial whether white people are allowed to say it. It's kind of interesting. It's also kind of weird, too, that, like, in, like, every other, like, institution that's doing sort of African American History Month programming is calling it Black History Month, but we're calling it African American History Month. So leave your comments about that. Leave your thoughts about that in the comments about Ratchet and African American History Month versus Black History Month. But anyway, so Ratchet by Shamir, the debut album by Las Vegas' own Shamir Bailey. It's a dance pop record, but it's decidedly lo-fi. It kind of sounds like a person singing in their bedroom, and I mean that in the best possible way. The track on the regular has to be a contender for Song of the Year.
Hi, hi, howdy, howdy, hi, hi. Well, everyone is minus, you could call me Multiply. Just so you know, yes, yes, I'm that guy. You could give five fingers and I'm not waving high. Yes, I'm never ending, you could call me Pi. But really, how long till the world realize? Yes, yes, I'm the best. What you heard? Anything less is
obviously absurd.
It is good to burn more like an eagle. This is my movie, stay tuned for the sequel. Seems so wrong, seems so illegal. Set this in the back like a foul ball free throw. Yep, yep, you know that I go. This is me on the regular, so you know. This is me on the regular, so you know. Yep, yep, you know that I go. This is me on the regular, so you know. This is me on the regular, so you know. I come with the tip, with the blow, with the boom. And if you're in my way, there's nothing but doom.
Or last year, as the case may be, it's sincere and it's fun and it's just a little dirty. And though this is a movie, it's actually a lot like Magic Mike, which I talked about last week, in the sense that no one can figure out what genre of music this is. And just like Magic Mike, that's what makes it awesome. But if you need a little nugget, a little blurb, I'd say it's like early Prince crossed with De La Soul. So much is made of...
I just heard my wife scream for joy.
Shamir Ratchet, check it out.
Okay.
The library has it on a format called CD.
Ooh.
So much is made of Shamir's gender identity, in the words of Maria Bamford.
Who gives a shit?
It is African American History Month. So I was thinking about black, queer, dance, pop superstars of the past. I could not help but to think of Sylvester. In the late 70s and early 80s, Sylvester was synonymous with disco, especially the disco subgenre known as high energy. Now, Mike, I have a feeling you might get some kind of like sci-fi kick out of this. That's high energy spelled H-I dash capital N, capital R, capital G. High energy.
I approve.
And that's high tempo, coked up dance music.
Woo.
You might know the song, You Make Me Feel Mighty Real. So Sylvester's lyrics are never as sincere or as personal as Shamir's, but both artists will make even the whitest get up and dance any month of the year. Most of Sylvester's discography is on Hoopla.
Okay. Disco rules.
Yeah, disco rocks.
Tickling my fancy this week is the Criterion Collection's The Complete Lady Snowblood.
Yeah!
Woo!
Toots agree.
This is a 1976 Japanese film directed by Toshiya Fujita, and it was a major source of inspiration for Kill Bill, from its revenge-based plot to the hissing fountains of spurting blood.
Hells to the yeah.
Yeah.
Mako Keiji is the best.
Mako Keiji stars as Yuki, also known as Lady Snowblood, cold-blooded assassin.
Yeah.
Bent on seeking revenge for her dead mother. The movie, I really like the structure of the movie with like the chapters and the way it sort of time hops with her origin story. And it even incorporates art from the original manga, which was written by Kazuo Koiki of Lone Wolf and Cub fame. There's an interview with him in the film. The DVD, it's a two-disc set. It also features the sequel, 1974's Love Song of Vengeance, which I couldn't really get into.
It was okay. I thought I was going to need this during like the Meiji Restoration, so it has both like really modern stuff and then like samurai stuff.
Yeah.
But, it's kind of slow.
It was very slow. It's like, the first one is, like, stylish and violent and the blood, and, like, kind of from the get-go. And then this one didn't have the verve, like the swagger.
It's worth seeing, but, don't get as excited.
Yeah. There was also a 2001 sci-fi remake of it called The Princess Blade.
Really?
I
like The Princess Bride.
I don't think we have that in the system, but look for that. But it is something else. Lady Snowblood. Beowulf?
Tickling my fancy is the television show called Bosch, which airs on Amazon Prime. Over the past week, I've been sick and snowed in, so I did a lot, and let me say a lot, of binge television watching. And of the shows I've watched, Bosch was my favorite. It's based on Michael Connelly's best-selling character, Harry Bosch, a Los Angeles homicide police department. Titus Welever plays Bosch, and he's perfectly cast. And it's a show that's meant to be binge-watched, to quote Lay's a potato chip commercial, you can't stop at one. I highly recommend Bosch, but however, I should say, by the way, I don't recommend binge watching, but if you're sick or snowed in, it's all cool. So,
is it on Netflix?
No, it's on Amazon Prime.
Oh, it's an Amazon Prime.
Bummer.
Sad face. Yeah. I like those books.
The Titus dude was the Man in Black, I think, in the last season of Lost. The smoke monster's real face.
Yeah.
So for my tickle my fancy, last year Brian and Bill both talked about the book Missoula, which was written by John Krakauer. And we've also talked about one of his most famous works called Into Thin Air, which is about his 1996 attempt to summit on Mount Everest and the tragedy that occurred during that climb. Recently, a book came across my desk from another climber who was also part of Rob Hall's ill-fated expedition with Krakauer. It's called After the Wind, and it chronicles Lou Kasich. I can't say his last name. Lou Kasich?
Sounds great.
It's hard to spell. They call him Luke because they just put like Luke K, so we'll just say Luke. His Everest experience. So I read Krakauer's version of events about a year ago and remember really enjoying it. He made it kind of seem like climbing Everest was something that anybody could do. And he had played around with climbing here or there, but hadn't really focused on it. Luke, on the other hand, was a dedicated amateur climber. He's climbed many of the lower peaks worldwide, and he trained hard for Everest, spending several winter nights on the windy beachside cliffs of his northern Michigan home in order to build up tolerance for Everest. In Krakauer's version, the author kind of blames the tragedy on a rogue storm, but Luke is more methodical. He argues that their leader, Rob Hall, made some bad decisions. First, embedding Krakauer in the first place, which caused their group to kind of become accountable worldwide if they didn't summit because he was blogging as they went. And second, they were competing with another professional climbers group, which kind of led to, road jam on the top of the mountain. Then Hall was leading from the back, and he also ignored his own turnaround time and other rules that he had set specifically for their safety. So Luke did not reach the top of Everest on that climb, instead choosing survival over the perceived, finger quotes, eternal glory. And he said he's never been sorry a day in his life. He's also never tried to go back and climb it again. When he was one and done on that. This really is a tragic story, the whole event. And it was the highest body count on Everest until fairly recently, a couple years ago, there was an earthquake in Nepal that killed 19 climbers. On this one in 1996, there were 8 that died that year. So it really was quite a momentous event. But it was good to get another viewpoint on what happened. I will admit that Luke is not as good of a rider as Krakauer, but his words are honest and forthright. He gets pretty blunt in places, too, saying, no, they were wrong, they shouldn't have done this. So that was kind of interesting. If you read Thin Air, liked Into Thin Air, you definitely need to check this one out and get kind of a different side of the story.
You know, I saw this interview with Krakauer, and he was taking, like, audience questions, and there was this 13-year-old kid who was, like, one of these, like, wonder kids, and he was climbing all the highest mountains. He had done K2 or just really super, like, one of the highest. And he asked, what should I know before I do Everest? And Krakauer was like, don't do Everest. Mm-hmm. He's like, it's crazy. I regret doing it. Like, it wasn't worth the damage that it did to my body and the psychological trauma of doing it. And you could tell the kid was just like,
whatever, old man.
I'm going next week.
Yeah, you could tell the kid was just like, does not compute. But that was interesting that he said that. He's like, don't do it. Listen, this all this hype around it, like, it's not worth. Like, there's so many mountains you can climb and have the same, you know, experience, but.
Well, and he said, like Kasich said, too, he was just like, they were going to the summit, and it takes like 6 weeks to go through this whole process, so it's not like you just go there, climb, and come down. Like, you have to acclimatize, and he's like, you know, if I would have known, like, I would have gone. Like, even as he was doing it, he's like, I wish this was over. So, I mean, I think that there's a lot of hype, and it's not, I wouldn't do it.
I'm going to do it. You talked me into it. I wasn't going to do it before today.
Yes, I sold Brian.
But now.
I've done the other 6 peaks, you know,
now,
K2.
Now I'm going to...
Whatever they call Mount McKinley now.
Now I'm going to do
Denali.
It.
Denali.
Yeah.
Have any corrections?
No.
Well, I'd like to. one of the things that would. I'm just talking. I kind of like veer between topics in the middle of like a sentence. So a couple of times I sounded either insensitive or lame in the last podcast. Or at least I thought I did. You know, I can't really blame an author for dying. You know, sure did sound like I did. You didn't finish your series, dead guy.
You're talking about Fritz Lieber.
Yes. And I didn't mean to say that, like, I was praising the Fast and Furious series for its diversity and immediately talked about meatheads in the same sentence. Sorry about that. I just changed my mind halfway through the sentence. Anyway.
We're improvising. It's all good. Considering.
I didn't think it was bad.
Yeah, it sounded bad to me. I
was
like, oblique.
Wow. Wow.
Oblique.
Along those same lines, I said Nora Roberts is ish, and I meant that in a positive way. When I said it, where I thought it, especially when I censored it, it sounded ambiguous. Anyway, we can stop with those corrections. More information about
defecation,
meatheads,
dead authors, for sure. You can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
And our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
Next week,
Valentine's Day.
Kissy face.
I'm talking about Night of the Living Dead.
Oh, it's a good one.
Yeah.
You want to change topic?
You guys can switch sheets.
There are people out there who have been wonderfully supportive and love the movie and love me in it, and I really do truly appreciate that. I've never taken that for granted. So I wouldn't want anyone to think that I am so arrogant as not to be grateful for the acclaim they have given me and the film. And it should never be misconstrued that my enigmatic, mysterious persona that I have in some instances deliberately created just to have the space in which to have a private life is a lack of gratitude. It's not. But it is my absolute insistence that I be seen as a total human being and not as Ben. Mm. Ben didn't even really have a biography. I mean, where was he coming from?
Yeah,
he just pulled up in front of the house.
Really? Just there, yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Ben was just passing through.